International Space Station, which has been delayed a couple of times now because of the low-fuel cutoff sensors in the hydrogen tank. As you know, now they've rescheduled it for February 7th, so we'll see if it goes off. They've worked on these connectors. These connectors are what they believe is the problem. They're very small, maybe about an inch and a quarter tops in diameter, that penetrate the external tank going into the hydrogen part of the tank. And if you look at the connector, it's like 37 pins. I mean, in this one tight little area of maybe an inch or maybe an inch and eighth in diameter. And these very fine pins, they believe, are touching the side of the connector, maybe inside the connector. You know, the tank goes down to minus 100 and whatever it is, 450 degrees Fahrenheit. Because they're getting loose and separating, not making contact. So what they decided to do is a similar fix to what they did on a Titan rocket, and they work on the Atlas program like this too. After connecting the connectors, they realized that same problem occurred. So what they did is they soldered the connectors. I saw a picture on a website, very fine soldering type of iron has to be used, they said, to get into all these connectors. They soldered them, 37 of them. And I think this is going to work. Once they plug it in, it'll be good to go. But they won't know for sure until they fill up the tank with hydrogen. So that's a heck of a thing to wait for, but they really believe that should be the cure. This has been giving them problems on and off for a good couple of years now. They need four of these sensors to be working. Once it goes down, if two go down, that's it. They scrub the mission. So, nothing but problems with this. Another thing I want to mention, over the weekend they had the Messenger spacecraft fly by Mercury. You might remember a couple of years ago, I think around 2004, they launched this thing from Earth and on its way to be the first.
Unfortunately, Paul, the machine was in the 2-minute timer mode, not supposed to happen before 10 o'clock, and therefore, except for the first minute, we lost all of what you said. I heard it all from the input. Beautiful material. Can I ask you to give us a synopsis of what you said, Bill, and Paul, and do every minute and a half do a carrier interrupt. WS2N, H-U-R-I-W. Sorry about that.
I think WHC.
Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, that was not supposed to happen. Eric is going to fix that now. There's apparently a problem with the controller. It's not supposed to be in the timer mode, number one, and number two, the link is not supposed to go down, so we're looking into that, just to let you know. Come back to me a second while I'm talking.
Okay, I'm back to you right now. Had to make sure I put the tone back on, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, Eric's working on it right now. So, just to let you know, we're working on the situation.
Remotely? Boy, what remote control?
Yeah, so please bear with us. I got a phone call from Eric. I'll be right back. Continue with the debt.
Roger, Dodger. Paul, if you'd like to give us a synopsis on that, and they think they've removed the timer, but just in case, get a carrier interruption every minute and a half. Back to you, Paul. Beautiful material.
Okay, Dick, I'll try to keep it a little short. The STS 122 going up February 7th. Problem with the reason for the delay was this connector, maybe about an inch in diameter. outside the connector. There's 37 pins. They think due to the cold temperatures, minus 400 some odd degrees, keep the hydrogen fuel cold. This pins are too, so close together, and they might be either touching one another or grounding themselves out, giving them false readings, telling them that the tank is empty when it's full or full when it's empty. They think they've got a good idea that that's the problem. They re-soldered all 37 pins with tiny little soldering iron, and they're going to put it into operation on February 7th. They'll know if it will work at that time. Let me drop it. So good, okay. Other information I wanted to give was on the Messenger spacecraft. Launched in 2004, a little over 3 years ago. So plan on going into orbit around Mercury in 2011. The spacecraft carries on it solar panels, batteries are nickel hydrogen batteries. The craft has a solar shade to it, made of a ceramic cloth, thick shade surrounding most of the craft to keep it cool. 10 times closer to the sun than Earth, temperature goes up to around 840 degrees, but the equipment on board will be room temperature because of the shade. Within inside the confines of the box, there's some 7 different test equipment besides cameras to take pictures. We've got gamma ray neutron spectrometers. We've got X-ray spectrometers. We've got magnetometers. We've got laser altimeters. Drop it. The mercury laser altimeter, for instance, gives you the exact topography of the planet as it goes around. It'll know the exact height, depth of everything that's on the planet. Magnetometer, planning on detecting the magnetic, it definitely has magnetic flux on the planet, so you want to check that out. They have an X-ray spectrometer that detects the elements. They've got gamma ray neutron spectrometers to detect whether or not maybe there's water in some of the freight is there. And different other things. They're even going to use the Doppler effect to check the gravitational force. Some might be stronger or weaker in different areas. You want to check that out. So with that, we'll be looking forward to eventually going to orbit. It's just business in the news over the weekend on the drop. It did pass Mercury within 120 miles altitude. It took some 1,200 pictures of the planet last time it was visited by spacecraft was 33 years ago. It said Mariner 10. And the difference between the pictures is like night and day when they make the comparison on what they're seeing. And they can now see the far side, part of the far side of Mercury where the Mariner 10 they weren't able to do that. And eventually in 2011 we'll be going to orbit around the planet and stay there for probably a couple of years. It's a very good science. But I tried to keep it short, but it didn't work. Back to that WS2N.
Don't worry, Paul. Good information. It's hard to tell when you give a drop out the ball's will because there's no beep. But the timer has been removed. And maybe we didn't have to do that, but it's safe that you did do that. I'm amazed that they would use a 36 or a 39 pin connector that's only 1 inch in diameter in the vicinity of a cryogenically cooled tank, which, if you're not real careful, when you have cryogenics like that, the normal air around it liquefies. So I think liquid hydrogen is at a colder temperature than liquid oxygen, so the oxygen content of the atmosphere around it starts liquefying. And unless there's some kind of a purging system to make sure there's nothing but dry nitrogen or dry hydrogen around, you think you're going to be building up a liquid oxygen around that connector. On top of that, such a small connector with such a large thermal change in temperature, you can easily get extraction of the pin. I mean, what's happened to many of us amateurs is that if you don't have the right kind of a connector at the top of the tower, as you rotate your rotator, the center pin retracts and doesn't make contact, or on a cold day, the center conductor of the coax cable shrinks and doesn't make contact. So do they think the liquid nearby making conduction was giving a phony signal? They think the pins were extracting because of thermal contraction, because of low temperatures. What's the best guess as to what was going on with that connector room? It's question number one I've got for you, Paul. And question number two, when you build a spacecraft that goes to Jupiter or Saturn, those are great big planets a long distance away in the outer portion of our solar system. Mercury, I think that Mercury and Venus, to me, are planets very nearby. How come it takes so many years to get there? And I believe they're using flybys in order to extract energy from the orbit so that the orbit of the spacecraft messenger ends up closer to the sun and therefore encounters Mercury. So did they have to do some flybys to get to Mercury? How come it takes so many years? And do they just fly by Mercury, or are they going to go in orbit around Mercury? Back to you, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Welcome to the W2EL repeater.
Okay, Dick, yeah, they're going to go in orbit around the planet in 2011, so quite a few years from now. A lot of flybys. You've got to actually get this thing going very quick. What if we go 66,000 miles an hour around orbit, around the sun? I forget how much faster Mercury is, but I mean, it goes around the sun in 88 days, so this thing is really long. You've got to not only go fast, you've got to be in this circular type orbit to, you know, you've got to, right now the orbit, they've got the orbit where it's just like between Mercury and Venus right now, where originally it started with, you know, more elliptical between Earth and the Sun. You've got to contract that all the way down to that orbit. It's not that easy. It would take a lot of fuel just to do it directly. Closer you get to the Sun, you actually have to go faster. You know, the planets are barely moving, the big planets. It's one of those dynamics. We drive it. As far as pins go, I'm inferring that from what I'm reading, minus 400 some odd degrees Fahrenheit. The pins themselves, 1 inch in diameter, they look like way too close together. Whether all 37 pins are used, probably not. But say they are, they show this connector. I can give you the website, bring up the picture. Very small, I'm guessing about 1 inch, maybe an inch and a quarter, top diameter, with all these 37 pins very close to one another. And they said maybe grounding it, you know, hitting the casing or something, as I remember reading it. I think it might be a case of separation of the pins, because they did talk about that at one point. Like what you're saying, the only way you're going to get that would be extreme cold. Put the connector together, and you think it's okay. You bring it down to this low temperature, and they contract. And, you know, that's what I think is going on. They had to bridge the gaps, they said, of all these different connectors. So they gave information more technical than they normally do on a NASA site, but still not quite enough. So back to you, WS.
I am guessing that they had it all to do over again. They should have used a much bigger connector in that area. Or was there something about the location where there was very little available volume? But somebody made a bad choice to use an ultra-miniature connector, high number of pins, very small connector, in a critical environment. And it's a very critical function, just a low tank indication, you know, empty tank indication, the liquid hydrogen tank. So have they said anything along the lines that they wish they had put a bigger connector in there, and is that going to be a future fix for the problem, Paul, go ahead.
No, it sounds like they're going to go with this idea. Came down from the group that engineers that technicians that worked on the Titan rocket, and then they'll also be working on the Atlas rocket. They have connected similar to that, and they ran into a similar problem, and they soldered the connections, and they came over to the external tank group and offered their assistance, and they think that they're going to fix it like this. And apparently on a permanent basis, I can't believe it, give me a big monster connector with big pins, for something serious like that. I agree, Dick. I don't know what's going on. Reason for it, I don't know. You're going to get into trouble like that, there's no question about it. Vibration, cold, and this and that. Back to you, Dick.
Fantastic. On top of that, is a connector really needed? The external tank does not get reused. So why is there a connector there? Reminds me of the big problem they had with one of the satellites they put up 15 years ago, where they put a fuse in the power supply of a satellite that's in synchronous orbit. Something went wrong. The power supply was being supplied more current than it was used to. The fuse blew. The fuse protected the power supply, and the satellite, major portions of it went dead. The last thing in the world you want to do on something that is absolutely positively unrepairable in space, you put something in synchronous orbit, you're never going to touch it again. Not even with a robot ship. So you don't want to put a fuse there. So in this case, do they really need a connector? Back to you, Paul.
Maybe they did at one time. At one time, the shuttle was supposed to take a Centaur rocket. They did away with them. Yes, that idea. They were going to take the Centaur rocket, put it in the back of the cargo bay, put an astronaut on board, and blast them up to geosynchronous orbit. I remember those predictions. And he's going to go up there and fix that fuse. Fix whatever's needed. That never came about. They dropped that idea after Challenger blew up. They didn't want any fancy rockets. Two bigger rockets in the cargo bay there. The connectors. Why do they need them? They need to get the information of what's going on inside the tank up to the orbiter itself and to mission control. They've got to see what's going on in those tanks. That's how they get their readings. All kinds of information. It's got to be coming off that tank. Now they have cameras on board the tank. Should they go with Wi-Fi? I don't know. These things were designed in the 1970s, so I don't think that idea would be feasible now. That's basically it, Dick. There's all kinds of connections coming off of that tank. Back to you.
Yeah, they need connections. They need wiring into the sensors in the tank. They need connections, but I don't think they need connectors, because why can't that wiring be permanently installed on that tank? Why do you have to disconnect it? One of the things that the people building military electronics have discovered a long time ago is that any kind of a socket, plug-in socket, stand by a second, has questionable reliability. A potentiometer has questionable reliability. So you build highly reliable electronics. You try to eliminate all connectors. You use solder joints instead. You try to eliminate all potentiometers, because these are very unreliable items. And the next in the list, though, real fast, is electromechanical relays. They can hang up on you, not make contact or not break contact when you want to, or make it break in the wrong sequence. So these electromechanical connectors and sliding connectors, that's what a potentiometer is, and make and break circuits, that's what the relays are, they try to avoid those. Kind of amazed that a lot of the people in the space business have a military background, and kind of amazed that they fell into this particular trap. So, with Messenger, we've got the highly elliptical orbit between Earth and Sun, and eventually between Venus and Mercury, and eventually it's going to be a circularized orbit. And yes, the way central force motion works everything in a lower orbit must move faster. Everything in a higher orbit is allowed to go slower. Opposite is common sense. And no astronaut on any kind of a rocket, even if you can launch the rocket in the cargo bay, no astronaut is ever going to go up to synchronous orbit. Because my next question, Paul, would be, even if you got the astronaut with all his repair tools up to synchronous orbit, tell me how you're going to get him back down. Back to you for a quick break on that one, Paul.
Yeah, this is a liquefied rocket, you know, similar to the Ohms rockets that they have on board the shuttle, the orbital maneuvering system, Ohms rocket, they call it. Yeah, you'd be able to fly it as on and fire it off, so it blasts out of the shuttle cargo bay up to 22,000 miles, and then turn their rocket facing the wrong direction, similar to what the shuttle does when it deorbits, and fire its rocket again and slow it down enough to get back into 180-mile high orbit that the shuttle was being taken. That was the plan. I remember the pictures of this, what they were designing and all. And that was a thought years ago.
And in my opinion, this is extremely non-practical, impractical. The amount of energy to get a astronaut and his tools and all of his life support system from low Earth orbit into geosynchronous orbit, LEO orbit. You got LEOs, MEOs, and GEOs. To get him up to GEO takes a tremendous amount of energy. To get him back from GEO down to LEO takes the exact same amount of energy again. So this great big booster, you better have another one up there that he can use to get back down. And when he gets back down, the first retro burn you make on the so-called beginning of the Holloman maneuver gets you back down as a more elliptical orbit, where now your apogee is geosynchronous and your perigee is low Earth orbit, but you enter low Earth orbit at a higher velocity. And you don't just go and hit the atmosphere that way, otherwise it's very similar to what happened when the Apollo astronauts came back from the moon. You better have one heck of a big heat shield, because you're moving at 25,000 miles an hour. And to hit that atmosphere and slow down, you better do it as a very controlled maneuver, not to exceed 9 Gs and kill the astronaut, or overheat the heat shield, or to just barely touch the top of the atmosphere and skip back out to, like a stone that you throw across the water. Not easy. So the chance of surviving all of this are not good. Just to repair a geosynchronous satellite, you're almost trading off a human life versus a satellite life, and I can tell you real fast which one's more valuable. And to build a robot ship that's capable of doing all this is difficult, very difficult. I know that there was some serious talks about a robot ship to do the Hubble repair. And when you watch an astronaut go through all the rigmarole of opening up those great big doors on the side of the Hubble, climbing in there, carefully taking apart connectors and screws and retainers that were never intended to be taken apart, replace great big sub-assemblies, carefully align everything, then put it all back together and use some kind of a jacking mechanism to force the doors to mate correctly, because with the thermal expansion of those things, they don't come back quite the way you want to. You don't just simply relatch those doors. To build a robot that can do all of that, to have all the observation and adaptability of a human being who's doing the repair, very, very difficult. I'll bet you as they studied the nitty-gritty of that problem, they rapidly came to the conclusion that the amount of time it's going to take to design and debug a remotely operated robot ship to do a Hubble repair is way beyond the time that Hubble is going to last before that repeater.
Timeout.
Cancel. Thank goodness they thought they canceled the timer. Obviously they didn't. Okay, yeah. I'm guessing they rapidly came to the conclusion that the amount of time to build and debug such a robot ship for Hubble repair is essentially out of the question. That's my guess. I wonder if you've read anything to sort of confirm that. Back to you, Paul.
Oh, I guess a year or so ago. Yeah, they dropped out of trialing, maybe longer. But yeah, they were considering that seriously. And I think we talked about it on the net. And I didn't think of it as much as a possibility. I think we predicted that, Dick, as I recall. So yeah, they thought they were going to design this thing, go up, take the panels apart, change out all the cameras, change out all the gyros and this and that. Fix solar panels, I don't think so. They're a long way from getting that kind of ability. So maybe a lot of money went into further research on that idea, but you know, from that, they might have got a good push. But no, they're back to a manned mission, STS-125. I think that's this year. Back to you.
Yeah, that was my next question. What is the anticipated launch date of STS-125, the Hubble repair?
I thought it was August. I'll have to check again. What we got to do is put it to Google STS-125 and see what happens. But yeah, that's they're planning for it. Who's working on it, training and everything, Jake. So that's a go.
And without Story Musgrave, that astronaut who did that beautiful heroic repair, it's going to be hard to find another person of that much enthusiasm and that much training. And he's already exceeded his lifetime exposure. I think he can't go back into space. But he'd be the right man to really do it right. Hubble's friend. Okay, yeah, Paul, thank you very much. Let's see, Mel, how's the mailbag doing? Mel, you're going to have to talk a little bit louder, because whenever I go back and do a sampling of the recordings of the TechNet that's on amateurradio.tv, your voice comes out a little bit lower than mine and a little bit more difficult to hear on those recordings. So speak a little bit louder there, Mel. And I hope your post office has gotten through reading your issue of QST and you saw those beautiful articles on Smith chart and L-pad matching. K2KEY, KQRIW.
This is W2L repeater. The time is 9:34 p.m.
Okay, yeah, good evening. I'm sorry I have the audio set. When I go on to the other repeater, they tell me I bang up against the edge of the repeater if I have the audio set for this point. So, okay, so now I've got to remember. I make myself a note. Leave it set for Limark, but it's set. All right, very good. You had a mailbag. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. I see I'm just pulling it off here. I just, you know, I haven't had a chance this week. Been busy as all heck. So, you know, I always, basically, it's spontaneous. You know, I have to really, first chance I get to really look at a lot of the emails and stuff, right when you say, you know, dig out the mailbag. First of all, you know what they have to do, Dick? They have to go back to World War Connections made by Jones or Bendix or Amphenol. You remember, or Millen. You remember those connectors they made? I got some in my junk box there that I'd be glad to let them have. They go to surplus place, and I think if they get those type of military connectors, remember they just spray them that crazy brown, that khaki color, and they had that ring on there. You put them in a ring on there, and it had that strain, that other piece that tightened up, that other ring in the back that tightened up against the cable and for the strain relief. And you remember, you could pick up the piece of equipment, it could be a 100-pound piece of equipment, but you could pick it up by that cable, and nothing would happen. I think that's what they should do, Dick. What do you think? Go back to the surplus connectors at World War II. I think that's what they need, rather than these new confounded Molex-type connectors that they seem to have jumped into over.
Yeah, be slow on that, though. I was a real enthusiast of these four-prong Jones connectors with four pretty large blades, two of them horizontal and two of them vertical. And that was the main connector that supplied V-plus and commanding to my assembly that was hanging behind my 2-foot dish at the 100-foot level of my tower. And that dish was used for 10 gigahertz, and all the electronics, the transmitter and the transverter, was in a weatherproof box behind the dish. And that's only a 2-meter signal that I fed up to it to command it, so to speak, to put it on the right frequency and the right mode of modulation. So I talked to it on 2 meters. It translated the signal to 0.2 watts of 10 gigs. And the 10 gig signal in the receive mode, it converted back to 2 meters for me and sent it down the cable into the shack. Well, that Jones 4-pin connector, after about 2 years, 3 years of service, rusted, corroded, did all kinds of things. Beautiful connector indoors, not an outdoor connector. So a completely weatherproof connector made for outdoor service probably needs silver-plated or gold-plated contacts, a real good weather seal. The Jones didn't have it, but maybe it's an inexpensive Jones that I was using. So if I want a reliable connector at the top of the tower, that's a difficult requirement. On the top of my tower, on the top of my hill, you get some pretty nasty weather. Very cold, very windy, ice storms, all kinds of things up there. I got to put a weather station up there to be able to tell people how bad it is. I'm also tempted to put a microphone up there so you can hear the wind whistling through the tower. From time to time, on a windy day, I put my ear against the guy wire, and I hear the wind whistling through the tower. And it's an exciting sound. I've got the contact microphone, I got to build a preamplifier and a remote power supply to run the whole thing so I can play you guys some of those sounds. So would I put a connector up there or would I do a soldering job up there is an interesting question. Obviously you lose the modularity of being able to put, disconnect, take it down to do a repair. But once you've got the connector, it's one of the highest things on your list of low reliability when it comes to military hardware. Look out for connectors. Back to you, Mel, KQIYW.
Actually, this is KQIYY. Well, the connector I'm referring to is like the Bendix connector that they made for World War II for the Navy Department. Those waterproof bulkhead connectors that had to withstand some real heavy weather, you know, and pounding and all. And I have, I mean, these are the old big ring ones. I think it may be, the Jones ones, like you talked about, the stage ones, you know, that you just plugged in, and that was it. But I'm talking about, like, for instance, like, you remember the big Bendix one that had that ring on the outside that you tightened to pull it in, Dick. The back had completely sealed up the back there with that special strain relief. That's one that, well, you know, World War II, I had a lot of surplus equipment that I broke up and I took some beautiful heavy connectors off of that. And well made, you know, tremendously made. I think that's what they mean. Okay. Anyhow, just passing. All right, so I think, let's see, what else I was going to say. Blah, 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 blah. Look, I'm just looking. I'm just going through what I here, a number of remarks coming, let's see. Oh, I got so many remarks about that power supply, you know, using a computer power supply for a source of a 12-volt power supply to power the rig. And, oh, I got so many people sent me all kinds of ideas and how well they made it, how great it is. Now they got this in abundance of one here. He says, now he says, I have a whole bunch of abundance of extra power supply. And all, and once I made up with heaters and things and panels and all that, okay, I'm happy everybody has found a good use for old computer power supply. Let's see, what is it called? Thank you also for the information you guys gave us on DB. At least I start to understand what all this stuff is about. Everything you read seems to be more confused. You get more confused when you read about a lot of this stuff, but you guys sort of simplify your honesty. All right, let's okay, so far, here's one, I wouldn't read them on the air, and I wouldn't answer them, so I'm just going over. All right, here's one. I have an old Nationals receiver I picked up, and I found it was very staticky. And I found the trouble is looks like a noisy IF transformer. What is wrong with this IF transformer? I'm looking inside of it. The coils look good, yet it makes a noise, some kind of a barking noise. I think I may know what's wrong with it. All right, you take it first.
Yeah, every IF can has got the, at least the majority of normal IF cans have a primary coil with a coil with a capacitor across it to resonate it, a secondary coil with a capacitor across it to resonate it, and a gap between the two and a tuning plug for the whole thing. What brings to mind here, Mel, is the worst radio and television repair I ever had in my history. There was a particular set in my hometown where I was the chief repair person in Middle Island, Long Island. This is 1959, roughly. And this particular television set, the complaint was, plays beautifully for 10 minutes and then dies. The screen goes white and the sound becomes a rushing sound. And I fiddled and fiddled and fiddled with it. I assumed that it had intermittent tubes. I soon discovered after replacing almost every darn tube in the set, that wasn't it. Removed the set from the house, brought it to my repair shop, which was the basement of my family's house, and sure enough, on the bench, it would do the same thing, play for 10 minutes, stop playing. I had just acquired an oscilloscope, I had the ability to do signal tracing, and I finally got to that IF can. I could see signal going in and nothing coming back out. The IF can had an intermittent opening when it got warmed up by the nearby tube. So the tube that was close to the IF can would heat it up in 10 minutes, something inside would expand, and the IF can became an open circuit, and all video stopped flowing through it. And downrange, the video got separated. It was a so-called intercarrier set. Downrange, there was a 4.5 meg resonator, which busted out the audio, and demodulated it. So it lost audio and video because of an intermittent opening up IF can. Under normal circumstances, the average person would consider that a very high reliability product. There was one other set that gave me a lot of trouble where there was a solid-state detecting diode on the last IF can of the strip. So the video detection, the amplitude detection of the video, had a crystal diode detector built into the IF can, and that crystal diode became intermittent when the set heated up. Intermittents, of course, are the most difficult kind. They can drive you wild. Nowadays, you've got heat guns and cold squirting devices and whatever. By thermally cycling each individual suspicious component, you can go a long way in finding bad ICs and bad capacitors and bad resistors and all kinds of things these days. You can squirt cold and hot at them, if you know what I mean. In your and my early days, we didn't have some of those luxuries. You could hold the tip of a soldering gun near a component and create some heating. But we didn't have cold spray.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Good thing I'm listening. So, and that timer is still there, fellas. So, intermittent. I'll bet you had a big pile of tricks on how you fixed intermittent, Paul. I mean, Mel. It used to drive me up a wall. And so, the good news is that some of the sets that were declared unfixable in basket cases, I would consider them a challenge, and most of them I eventually found the intermittent. And that was, at least in my mind, a hero when I did it. So what were some of the tricks you used to find intermittent? And I bet some of them drove you up a wall. K2KEY, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I just said
K2KEY.
Well, went through all those problems and all. I used to have a blanket, throw a blanket over the set to cook it, because a lot of times, you know, you put the chassis up on a bench, it's open in the air, the problem doesn't show. So throw the blanket over it and let it, you know, cook. But I had all those crazy, one crazy thing after another. Worst one I ever had, and I'll tell you, mentioned, now we're talking about IF. They had a television, I'll never forget, with a magnifier. And the picture tube had gone bad in the set. They took the picture tube, they brought a new picture tube up. It was one of the old 21-inch sets. black and white. Put the set apart, put a new picture to it, put the set back, chassis back, turned it on, can't get no vertical hold. The vertical keeps rolling. So, I changed two things, of course, right there, nothing. Pulled the set into the shop, and I wasn't there that day. I was in school. I used to come in and work part-time in the shop. I was the so-called dog man. And I came in, when I came to this place, back to, stopped in the place, they told me, oh, you got to look at this one, this is a bad one. Vertical won't hold, they changed every capacitor, this thing, that thing, and the vertical circuit still won't hold. So I take a look at it, you know, for the few seconds that it seems to want to hold and all. I noticed also some kind of a little bit of a, some kind of smear in the video. Well, make a long story short, I put the generator on it. I forced them to buy a B&K analyst Lyman generator, crystal Lyman generator, because they were old-schooling with the IF. That was a problem. You used to get an all-time. You had a set that was playing, and a technician came in into the house, the service guy, and it was like an ATC problem or something like that. Right away, he had to think maybe I had to touch up the IF a little bit or something like that. So I said, well, I know it's not a component in the vertical circuit, it's changed everything in there. And when I did the, went to do the IF, check the IF alignment, I found that two slugs, you know how the slugs used to be held in those goddamn coils with this like piece of rubber band that held the slugs in the coil, you know, it rode up and down on a piece of rubber band as the ship. It must have dried up and everything, and when they took the chassis out of the set to put the, picture tube in, the slugs banged up against each other. And those were the original, you know, the old dagger tubes IF stick over.
Wow, that's a tough one. So you had one of these tuning tools which had a hex tip to it and a long plastic rod, and so you could reach through the first slug to get to the second slug, or in some cases you tuned above the chassis for the upper slug and below the chassis for the lower slug. So by one means or another, you discovered those two slugs were slammed up against each other, and that little piece of rubber in there wasn't there. How in the world did you get that out and replace it, Melvin?
Okay, well, the slugs fell down against each other. And, of course, you had tuning wands, you know, with the stem that would go through. So the only thing I did, went from the bottom. I just pushed the two of them back out, both slugs out. Took another piece of rubber band. I used to get the rubber bands back from the dentist. That was the rubber band used to be used for the braces on the kids. That little tiny rubber band.
Perfect.
You just have to cut them and, you know, split them. And you put it in, drop them in there. As you hold the rubber band, as you turn the plug in, get the second plug in, redo the alignment, all fixed. That was it. They stood there, the shop there with their mouths open. They were betting behind my back that this one they'll never fix. This one, he's never going to figure this one out. But the telltale sign, like I say, you got to observe. See, that was the whole secret. Observe. Observe very carefully. In fact, my teacher, my electrical teacher in Brooklyn Tech, one of the most successful ways to be a good technician in this business is, he said, if the set was playing perfect, how would you make it play to develop this kind of problem? In other words, what would you do to the set, the television set, to create this kind of problem? And that was a good way to work on it. That's why I used to say, well, let's see, how can I make this happen? And, of course, I saw that fear in the video. That was right away a giveaway. I think, oh, I can go on and on and on. I had lots of thoughts. But, all right, getting back to this IF, unless somebody wants to make a comment.
There was a GL repeater system.
So because the IF strip was so misaligned, didn't have the stagger tuning anymore, and had very limited frequency response, therefore you saw all the low frequency notes on the picture were there, but the high frequency notes, the sharp edges were missing. The sync pulses that are trying to be separated by the sync separator are sharp pulses. It's got a leading edge detector and a trailing edge detector, a differentiator circuit. So if the circuit becomes low enough in frequency response, there's nothing left to differentiate, and the poor sync separator had nothing to work on, and therefore the picture rolled. Did it roll vertically, horizontally, or both, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, the horizontal hold wasn't bad, really. Maybe it got a little critical, but not bad. What I saw observed right away on a scope is that the vertical sink pulse is buried. It was suppressed, really, because of the response. You know, the vertical sink pulse, of course, was much more critical than the horizontal sink pulse, which is a larger pulse, basically, you know, the way it existed, the way it's put, you know, through the sink separator, was most likely able to differentiate enough of the horizontal sink pulse to keep it more or less locked in the sink horizontally. But vertically, it was just, yeah, you could fiddle with it, but you could see it was bouncing. In other words, it was a weak sink pulse. Basically, that was what gave it all away, the weak sink pulse. And just looking for the sink pulse right away with the generator on it, I could see the sink pulse was just not really there, and just backing up. It didn't take me that long. They figured, oh, this is going to be one for many hours of work. I think I solved it and had it all working less than an hour with all the mechanical work I had to do to get the slug out and everything like that. Yeah, I guess you could order another IF and put it in that way, but I took a shot at repairing it. Now, as far as this IF is going, this noise like this, the way that compression capacitor is put into the IF that were used in National and all, you can't get that capacitor out because it's a rivet on the bottom that holds that capacitor and clamps it in there. It's a rivet. And the it's got springs, like, I call them, they call them spring contacts that compress against each side of that mica element. So what you have to really do is you have to really abandon that in the bottom of the IF can. And what you do is you have to redo it a little different. You have to make up, you can pick up another pin, or you have to punch through sometimes. They have, usually what they have is an extra slot, it's a 4-pin can. You'll see it's punched out for 6 pins. So you've got to just move the, in other words, abandon what you have in there and put a external capacitor. Usually you look on the schematic, they'll tell you what the capacitance was across the curl. And what you do is you have to make up 2 extra pins and abandon that one, because there's no way of disconnecting it unless you know the trick to disconnect that capacitor in the bottom of the IF stick over.
Yeah, I think you're right. Unremovable. Those micro compression type variable capacitors, very reliable item most of the time. Now, the person who wrote you that email believes that the IF can is making noise. And let's hope he's right. Because an IF can becoming intermittent, where it's an open or a short or detuned, or the slugs come together, those are easy. But for it to make noise, radio noise, a little bit on the rare side, because for the most part, you don't have high voltage across them. The coil itself is almost a short circuit. Current flows through it, but not a great deal. But there's very little voltage drop anywhere. So the ability of it to make noise is limited. So let's hope that he's troubleshot down to the right component. And just think, Mel, modern-day guys who do repairs, because sets are no longer repairable. You've got a couple of modules in there where you just rip out a printed circuit board and you plug another one in, and you throw away the old one. You don't even troubleshoot them. The IF can, the preamp, the IF amplifier stages, the detector stage, the sink separator, the color demodulating matrix circuit, all of this jazz is now inside of an integrated circuit. So the individual components you and I worked on essentially no longer exist as a separate thing that you and I can touch, troubleshoot, signal trace, whatever. Nowadays, massive portions of the receiver, there's an input pin on the integrated circuit chip, and there's a couple of output pins, and in between magic displays. So can you imagine training a repairman today for television repair compared to what you and I witnessed and experienced back in the late 50s and early 60s? It's a different world, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is KQKEY. Well, you want to know the quick way of a trick to make sure that IF is bad. There's a simple trick what you do. You disconnect the lead that goes from the IF to the plate of that tube that it's connected to. Let that, in other words, this takes off the wire that goes from the IF to the plate. Now what you do is you're going to put a resistor. Now, the way it was wired, the B plus went through the coil and wound up at that plate of that tube of that stage. You disconnect that plate. Now you take a resistor, and you're going to put a resistor that is approximately the value of the plate resistance of the tube. Look up the tube, and they'll tell you what the plate resistance of the tube is. You put that resistor as a substitute from that where it was connected to the plate. The plate is now floating, moving. You put that resistor now to ground. If the noise persists, then you know that the IF is bad. In other words, you're isolating that IF. And if you want to make sure, if you want to shut the noise down, see if it shuts down, you take your shunt, like a 0.01 capacitor from the grid and the cathode of that next stage. You temporarily just put from the grid, that's where the IF connects to the cathode, which is grounded. And that will, if it shuts the noise down, then you've isolated the IF. So that's a way of determining, you know, right away. In other words, you're isolating the stages before when you disconnect the plate. Put that resistor in, which is completing the circuit for the flow of the plate voltage. But, in other words, because if you can't knock the plate voltage off and let the IF float, you most likely won't hear no noise. But that doesn't tell you the IF is good or bad. So by putting the plate resistor to ground and leaving the plate float from the previous stage, and the noise is still there, then you can confirm it then by then putting your capacitor from the grid to the cathode, a 0.01, and if it kills the noise, that's it. That's, you isolated that particular IF as the noise source. That's the way I used to do it, Dick, over.
That's a good technique. You're putting the normal current and voltage through the IF can, and instead of that current flowing into a tube, it's flowing into your resistor. And if the noise persists downrange, beautiful test. Another test would be signal tracing. A good oscilloscope with enough gain where you can see the signal at each one of the stages, and you can touch each one of the grids and anodes and work your way from the antenna all the way back toward the cathode ray tube and look at the signal getting stronger, look at whether or not there's any noise on the oscilloscope. That's another way you can do it. And I kind of like the oscilloscope test because it's a little bit more of a in situ, in other words, in the living animal, you're making the measurement under working conditions. Your resistor substitution is going to work 95% of the time. Once in a blue moon, the tube acts a little bit differently than the resistor, and the noise may change, and it might not be there. So signal tracing. Now, signal tracing comes in two different flavors. Into a good oscilloscope with a good time 10 probe, which does very light loading of the circuits and very light detuning. Beautiful technique. Guarantee you did a lot of troubleshooting with a good Tektronix oscilloscope. Another trick that's not well known is that you can take the time 10 scope probe, instead of plugging it into an oscilloscope, use an adapter and plug it into the front end of the spectrum analyzer. Tune the spectrum analyzer to the right frequency, maybe in the zero span mode. Now you have fantastic increase in sensitivity from an oscilloscope. A good spectrum analyzer is about 40, 50 dB more sensitive than a good oscilloscope. So you can look at very small signals, and you can isolate if it's a 48 megacycle or a 45 megacycle IF. You can set the spectrum analyzer to 45 meg and look at just those components if that's what you're interested in. Now, when you put a times 10 scope probe, which is made to go into an oscilloscope where the oscilloscope is a mega-ohm input impedance, so to speak, and you're putting it into the input of a spectrum analyzer, which has got a 50-ohm input impedance, the frequency response becomes a little bit slanted. It favors high frequencies, but that's calibratable. And also, there's a huge insertion loss. In other words, a times 10 scope probe into a spectrum analyzer has an extra 20 dB of loss. But that's not bad, because the spectrum analyzer's got 40 or 50 dB or more sensitivity. You just have to be a little bit careful about how you do your calibration of signal strength, and there's ways you can get around that. But I like signal tracing. I like to watch that signal at each stage as I walk down that series of stages. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, no doubt that the elegant way to do it is K2KEY. Of course, that's the right way to do it, just to stick to this outline. However, you know what else they used to have? They used to recommend in the old handbook and all that you build one of those tracing amplifiers. You remember with a demodulator probe, was just basically an audio amplifier. In fact, each kid used to put out one of those things. And remember, they used to supply you with a demodulator probe so you could actually hear the stations tick over.
This is the W2L repeater.
That's a good technique. And the nice thing about that little demodulator probe is it's very portable, whereas an oscilloscope is quite a bit less portable, and a spectrum analyzer in the old days was very not portable. Now, they were a 78-pound piece of equipment. Well, nowadays, the modern-day spectrum analyzer or network analyzer has got a liquid crystal screen, got a battery inside, it's highly portable. That's the good news. The bad news is that all modern-day, highly portable spectrum analyzers and network analyzers have digital signal processing. At first, it sounds good. The DSP can synthesize any bandwidth of filter you want, but the machine is extremely non-real time. When I use a network analyzer, and I said it correctly, as I'm tuning up a circuit, the screen is flashing new information so fast that it's real time. I can put my finger on the circuit, and I can see the trace on the screen change immediately. So with portable network analyzers, you make some kind of a change, and you wait 20 seconds for the screen to repaint the picture indicating the change. Well, recently I was tuning up an extremely high-Q 10-pole filter, and I tried doing that tuning on a modern-day network analyzer. I rapidly came to the conclusion I will not live long enough to do it this way. Because when you're tuning a 10-pole filter, and there's a huge amount of interaction between those poles, each time you turn a screw, you got to wait 10 or 15 seconds for the signal to be repainted on the screen, or you start using very strong, salty language real fast. If you were a neophyte and didn't know any better, maybe you wouldn't use strong, salty language. But if you've used good instrumentation, good laboratory instrumentation, which delivers all the information in real time, and suddenly you've got a 10-second delay, you find it intolerable. So when you look at these great advertisements, they tell you about all the horns and whistles and sensitivities and accuracies and frequency ranges and whatever. None of them mention what is the latency time between the change you created in the outside world and the time that it appears on that screen. They just happen not to mention that in the advertisement. And my goodness, is that, in some circumstances, a very significant parameter. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, so
well,
I think
then
the people designing this type of equipment are engineers that have never worked in space technician. They don't know what to put. Good, Mel.
You're right there, Rich. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, you're 100% right, Rich. 150% right. Give that man again a cigar. I know you. I think he gave up smoking, so I can't give you no more cigars, Rich. It's K2KEY. No, but you're 100% right. These virtual screen sticks, I don't care to use those instruments. I still like what I use on my bench. I have my 150 meg Tektronix old CRT screen, regular picture tube in there, and love it. Love it for most of everything I do. Unfortunately, I just say, unfortunately, you can't get those instruments anymore. And so I still love that old Tektronix. I have also 150 meg Tektronix DSO with a regular picture tube in it. I like it. That's the type of instrument. And in fact, I always get funny looks when I still use my Simpson 260 BOM for a lot of testing. And they take those digital meters and everything and waiting for the...